Next matter we have on this afternoon is docket number 81704, PM Plumbers Local Unit 5119 Pension Trust Fund with Zirgin. Council, are you ready to proceed? Okay. And, okay.
May it please the court, my name is Randall Barron. I am counsel for the appellant shareholders. I would like to reserve my remaining time, which I anticipate would be 3 to 4 minutes for rebuttal. Before we go forward, I think it helps to have some definition of some cases because Dish Networks was involved in a number of different cases that are before the court. So when I speak of Dish 1, I am referring to this court's opinion in In re Dish Networks derivative litigation from 2019. When I speak of USB Dish, I'm talking about a June 2017 decision from the Central District of Illinois. When I speak of Krakauer, I'm speaking of a Krakauer v. Dish Network case from the Middle District of North Carolina from May 2017. And Dish 2, I am talking about the underlying opinion from the district court in the matter before the court right now. This dispute all arose as a derivative action focusing on the specific conduct or misconduct of primarily two officer directors from Dish Network and the rest of the board that caused the company to pay over $300 million in civil judgments, thereby harming Dish Networks. In connection with the civil judgments, two separate courts, that's USB Dish and Krakauer, in two separate jurisdictions, affirmed by two separate appellate courts, made express findings that can be interpreted to say that at least two of the named defendants, and maybe more, as senior officers of Dish knowingly violated the law, thus justifying the judgments. In lieu of challenging the standing of shareholder plaintiffs via demand futility and the rules set forth in both in Schoen, et cetera, they nonetheless decided by a fully conflicted board that they would adopt the special committee of three persons, two of which were the SLC members in Dish 1, and one of those two was actually determined in Dish 1 to be a conflicted board member. Without considering the inferential and collateral estoppel effects of those prior opinions, the SLC recommended dismissal, sought to expropriate this action from plaintiffs and ultimately court oversight, and recommended dismissal. And they did so in a motion for summary judgment. They selected the as a motion for summary judgment. In that motion itself, the SLC never argued that the standard was anything other than summary judgment, certainly not that it was a preponderance.
Didn't counsel stipulate to an evidentiary hearing?
We agreed that there is an evidentiary hearing, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But an evidentiary hearing is not a trial. And an evidentiary hearing, in fact, we can go so far as we can look to NRCP Rule 43, which actually defines the difference, right? And this is a critical point, that under NRCP Rule 43, subsection C, a court may hear evidence, both testimony and oral, or it can accept the deposition, testimony, and other documents as the evidence. And in fact, that's what this court did in Dish 1, right? In Dish 1, the court actually deemed the depositions and the documents that were submitted with the summary judgment motion as being evidence. So there was no magic of us agreeing that there could be evidence. There can be evidence in any hearing before the court, and we can go look at the types of hearings that have them, right? That you can have a prove-up proceeding, right, where you're proving that somebody complied with a court order, in which you call evidence. You can have a preliminary injunction in which there is evidence. Just because there is evidence presented does not make it a trial, and certainly does not alter the standard of review for that underlying decision by the trial court. And if you look at that issue, and in fact, that is the issue that we want to focus on most, is what is that standard of review here? And I think that is the critical issue. There's other issues raised in our pleading, but the critical issue really is the question of what is the appropriate standard of review.
You mean at the district court?
At the district court level, yes.
Because we already held what our standard of review is.
And I have no issue, and I have no issue with that. I do understand that Justice Pickering had an issue with that in the dissent in Dish 1, but I don't think that just because there is a standard of review which gives an abuse of discretion standard, that inherently changes the standard of proof and the burden that the SLC should have. Now, it's important in this case in particular because the district court expressly ruled that in footnote 3, if it did apply a standard of review that was summary judgment, then the SLC would not have met their burden. The court instead made the determination that it was a preponderance of the evidence standard, and under the preponderance of the evidence standard, the SLC met their burden of demonstrating that they were sufficiently independent, again, with a majority of the SLC, and that they had demonstrated thoroughness and good faith, or sufficiently demonstrated that under that standard.
Mr. Barron?
Yes, ma'am.
So in the case you're referring to as Dish 1, in footnote 2, this court said the standard we adopt from Auerbach involves assessing the weight and credibility of the evidence and reaching conclusions that depend greatly on factual determinations. If the court is evaluating credibility and making factual determinations, that doesn't sound like genuine issue of material fact standard, does it?
It does to me, and let me explain why.
Okay.
First off, I don't claim to be in a better position than this court to interpret what this court intended or meant.
Sure. Well, I wasn't here in 2017, so maybe we're on the same page.
And it would be somewhat hubris for me to do so, but I can point to what is in that and not in that decision, right? In that decision, first off, the court adopted Auerbach, right? And in the way Auerbach is applied, now, while it did change it and say that if the appellate court is going to review that, it would do so on abuse of discretion, Auerbach, and indeed every other SLC motion that is throughout the country, whether it is under Zapata or Auerbach, is always an evidentiary determination. You have to submit, it is not just a pleadings motion, you have to submit affidavits or evidence, or in the case of Nevada, asking that, which we can do in Rule 43, bringing in live testimony. But it is always, and indeed, a summary judgment is always somewhat of an evidentiary determination, right? The courts are balancing that and determining whether or not there are material issues of fact, but they are looking at evidence to do so. Second, in Dish 1, the court did not use the word preponderance. It absolutely could have used the word preponderance. It did not. Thirdly, in that the court did not say we are reducing that standard of proof on the burden of the SLC. And that's important, I think, because of the colloquy that occurred between Justice Pickering and the majority. And in that colloquy, and again, Justice Pickering would, of course, know far better than I guess you and I would.
Right.
But in there, Justice Pickering took issue with two things that she said were most deferential, made this the most deferential version of the SLC. And those two things were, one, the review standard, the appellate review standard is being discretionary, abuse of discretion as opposed to de novo. And the other was whether or not the SLC could be less than completely independent. She did not take issue with a reduction in that standard of review from what Auerbach and indeed every other court that looks at this would apply. And indeed, we cited dozens, literally dozens of cases following Auerbach, all of which were summary judgment. All of them were one and done. All of them, you make your summary judgment, either you prevail or you don't. The SLC did not cite a single situation in which there was a subsequent preponderance level evidentiary analysis. So I think that the evidence is there. And finally, and I mentioned it a moment ago, which is NRC Rule 43. If indeed what this court meant was this is a trial, right? This is a trial in which the standard is now preponderance, the court could not have done what it did, which is deemed the depositions to be evidence. Because again, NRCP Rule 23 specifically says that at trial, witness testimony must be taken in open court, which means, and it wasn't in Dish 1. I don't think there's any question that in Dish 1 it was not. So therefore, if that's what the court meant, then their solution would have had to remand that situation back to district court to take open testimony for it to be a trial.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that the opinion in Dish 1, in particular footnotes 2 and 3, cut against your position that Nevada, in fact, has adopted mainstream Auerbach jurisprudence?
Well, I do. I think that as you pointed out in your dissent, that they adopted an extreme deferential version, that the majority believed that there were situations, which I agree with you, don't really exist, in which there can be less than full majority. But I think as far as the adoption, as to the process, I think it was pretty clear that they were saying, we adopt Auerbach. The choice that the majority seemed to have at the time, and what the issue was, are we going with Auerbach or are we going Delaware Zapata?
One quick question. You agree that Lillis meets the standard of disinterestedness. Is that correct?
I agree that Lillis was found to be disinterested in this. I think that Lillis was in a very different position in Dish 2 than it was in Dish 1. By Dish 2, he had already been an actual director of the corporation while conduct was going on. By Dish 2, he was appointed in that role without the special provisions. Recall that in Dish 1, I can't tell whether the court said less than a majority is meant to be the standard or in that unique circumstance where they add a new completely outsider to that panel, and you do so with what is fundamentally a veto power, right? Yeah. Lillis could not, there was no way the SLC could vote to recommend if Lillis did not agree to do so. So that unique circumstance allowed for that situation there. I don't know whether it's true, so therefore I don't know that Lillis is in exactly that same point. I think we argued below that he was not.
All right, I have a 2 minutes and 40. Any other questions, colleagues? Would you like to reserve your remaining time?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Stephen Peek on behalf of the Special Litigation Committee. This court should affirm the district court's decision to dismiss the plaintiff's complaint. The district court meticulously adhered to this court's Jacksonville standard. He called it Dish 1, I call it Jacksonville. In holding an evidentiary hearing and making detailed factual findings confirming the Special Litigation Committee's independence and the good faith thoroughness of its investigation, the district court did not abuse its discretion in making those findings. Plaintiff's appeal appears to rest primarily upon two extraordinary misstatements. First, plaintiffs misstate Jacksonville, contending that it forbade the district court from making factual findings. In fact, Jacksonville not only permitted factual findings, it required them. Second, in arguing abuse of discretion, plaintiffs say that the SLC's report could not have been thorough and in good faith because it did not address certain issues. As the district court found, the SLC plainly addressed them. We respectfully submit that plaintiffs are attempting a different gambit. They state that Jacksonville precludes factual findings because they want that to be the case. They want this court to overrule Jacksonville and adopt a summary judgment standard. They argue the substance of the issues in an effort to discredit the SLC and to support their argument that Jacksonville somehow permits abuse by an SLC. This court should reject that gambit. The district court did not commit legal error by making factual findings. Jacksonville tells us that the district court is to hold an evidentiary hearing to determine whether the SLC lacked independence or failed to conduct a thorough investigation in good faith. It also tells us the, quote, standard we adopt from Auerbach involves assessing the weight and credibility of the evidence and reaching conclusions that depend greatly on factual determinations. There was no legal error. Plaintiffs argue because the SLC's motion was styled as a motion for summary judgment, the district court should not have made factual findings. It should have applied a summary judgment standard. This is contrary to the record. After the motion was made, the plaintiff requested and received Rule 56F, now 56D, relief. Discovery was granted, and thereafter, they jointly requested with the SLC a Jacksonville evidentiary hearing. That was clear in the joint request. As the district court found, it, quote, scheduled an evidentiary hearing on the motion to defer at the joint request of the parties in conformance with the requirements of an evidentiary hearing set forth in Jacksonville. Plaintiffs requested a Jacksonville evidentiary hearing, and that's what they received. If there were error, plaintiffs invited it and cannot now complain of it. There was no error.
Mr. Peake,
with respect to plaintiffs,
Mr. Peake, this is Justice Hardesty up in Carson City.
I see you, Justice Hardy. It's nice to hear from you in Carson City.
Okay. It seems to me that your opponent overreads or even misreads footnote 3 in the order. To the point you were making a moment ago, it seems like paragraph 13 of the court's order was trying to explain the point that these motions had been filed first by the SLC as a motion for summary judgment, and then later... summary judgment, and then later a motion to defer. And she's making the point that these are two different motions to be addressed in two different factual determinations. In this instance, she used preponderance, the judge did, as opposed to a summary judgment, because summary judgment is different. And that's exactly what Jacksonville said. Is that your argument?
Your Honor, I don't know if there's a question there, but let me respond. I agree with the court that in that paragraph 13, which is footnoted to that paragraph 3, she was talking about, as I read it, two different standards. One is Jacksonville requires an evidentiary hearing. I granted an evidentiary hearing at the request of both parties, and that's what I did. With respect to plaintiffs' veiled argument for change in the legal standard, the court should not overrule Jacksonville. Stare decisis strongly discourages the overruling of precedent, particularly very recent precedent, like Jacksonville. Jacksonville is well-reasoned. It is consistent with shown in Amoco. Amoco's requirement of an evidentiary hearing and factual findings in the similar context involving the decision of a board of whether to pursue litigation. Plaintiffs are wrong to contend that Auerbach, on which Jacksonville relied, supports their position. The Auerbach court applied a summary judgment standard because the SLC was moving for summary judgment and had no opposition. The Auerbach court made clear, if the plaintiff had presented a genuine issue of material fact, the next step would have been an evidentiary hearing. Auerbach asked whether the plaintiff, quote, by tender of evidentiary proof, in admissible form has shown facts sufficient to require a trial of any material issue of fact as to the adequacy or appropriateness of the modus operandi of the committee. They would have held that trial. The Auerbach court did not suggest that if the SLC lost its motion for a summary judgment, the plaintiff could then bypass the SLC and proceed on the merits with no resolution of the issues that have precluded summary judgment for the SLC. Plaintiff's proffered summary judgment standard would conflict badly with Nevada's statutory business judgment rule in NRS 78.138 subpart 3, recently reaffirmed by this court in Guzman. It would conflict badly because based upon the mere raising of an unresolved genuine issue concerning the SLC's independence or good faith thoroughness, the district court would be prohibited from deferring to the SLC's business judgment. This would be true even if the evidence showed that the SLC was in fact independent and had conducted a good faith investigation, as the district court did. Disallowing deference to to independent SLC members who have informed themselves in good faith is the antithesis of the business judgment rule. Finally, there is no merit to plaintiff's suggestion that under Jacksonville, Nevada courts will not detect abuse by an SLC. After fulsome discovery and a full trial on the independence, good faith, and thoroughness of an SLC, the district court is well positioned to detect abuse. It is no reason to change the Jacksonville requirement of an evidentiary hearing. On the factual findings, the district court...
Would you say there's a jury trial right under your vision of Auerbach?
I'm sorry?
Would you say that there's a jury trial right?
No, I don't think so, Justice Picker, because I think that's more of an equitable matter. So I think that it would not require or allow for a jury trial because it's an equitable proceeding. That'd be my sense of it. But in this case, the district court held essentially a trial on the question of whether there was good faith or...
And it was stipulated.
On the factual finding, the district court decision should be upheld. There was no abuse of discretion.
Did the district court articulate what the concerns were that prompted, I think it's footnote 2, where she states, on an evidentiary hearing basis, preponderance of the evidence, I find in favor of the SLC's recommendation, but were I to judge this under summary judgment standard, I would find a genuine issue of material fact, independence, and good faith. Did she articulate anywhere in the record what the basis was for that?
Well, surprisingly, Your Honor, when I read the findings of fact conclusions of law which she issued, I was certainly not understanding what she was trying to say in that footnote 3, but I agree with Justice Hardesty that it really is saying, look, that may have been what the motion was, but based upon what the joint application of the parties was to hold an evidentiary hearing, I went forward with that evidentiary hearing, and I made the necessary findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment.
But to repeat my question, she never identified what the genuine issues were that would have given her pause applying a summary judgment standard.
That is correct, Your Honor. If she had thought the summary judgment standard was the proper standard, but she was saying Jacksonville compels me to hold that evidentiary hearing, and you all asked me to do it.
That gets to my question, Mr. Peek. I don't think she was saying that at all. I think what she's trying to explain is that there's a difference between the standard applicable to a motion for summary judgment and the standard she's to apply in a motion to defer under Jacksonville. That's it.
Otherwise, I would agree.
Otherwise, she would have expanded, I would think, knowing this judge in particular, what different results she would have arrived at using a different standard. But she never articulates that at all. She's just pointing out the difference between the two motions that the parties are pursuing.
I agree with you, Justice Hardesty.
But the parties only filed one motion.
The plaintiff only filed one motion, but when in the face of that motion, the plaintiffs made a 56F, now 56D, request by affidavit, identifying what discovery they needed in order to defeat the motion for summary judgment, that was granted. And then upon a later joint application, after receiving all of that evidence that they requested and to which they stipulated, we had an evidentiary hearing. So it did not become any more a summary judgment standard. It now became an abuse of discretion when you move forward with the evidentiary hearing. There was no abuse of discretion. They say the plaintiffs try to say that it wasn't a good faith thorough investigation because the SLC failed to address a handful of issues. But the issues were plainly addressed. The SLC's consideration of the issues was well documented in the report. I have it here, some 350 pages. And the district court found that the SLC had addressed the issues identified. For example, plaintiffs contend that the SLC failed to consider the adjudicated facts in the DNC action. And I heard today something that I didn't see in the record, which is that the two decisions in U.S. versus Dish and Krakauer found that there were two directors who had been made knowing violations. That is not the case. There's no finding whatsoever like that. So they contend that we fail to consider the adjudicated facts. Not true. As is readily apparent from the SLC report, and as the district court itself found, quote, the SLC accepted the decisions in the DNC actions as fact and reviewed those determinations and considered them in reaching its conclusion. 19 pages of the SLC report directly addressed those decisions. The SLC answering brief details where each of the issues was addressed. And even if the SLC had not addressed every one of those issues that plaintiffs desire, it would not matter. The Jacksonville standard is satisfied unless the SLC's investigation is so incomplete as to be a sham, which it clearly was not. The plaintiffs seek to sow doubt about the substance of the SLC determinations. Their arguments should be disregarded. This court held in Jacksonville, quote, the inquiry into whether the SLC made its determination in good faith and on an informed basis focuses on the process used by the SLC rather than the substantive outcome of the process. And in Wynn, this court reminded us before Jacksonville came down that the court should not review the substance of a board decision in assessing good faith. There's no reason to doubt the substance of the SLC's determinations for DISH to recover from the director defendants under NRS 78-137-1387B. DISH would need to prove that the director defendants knowingly caused DISH to violate the DNC laws. The SLC exhaustively investigated that issue, finding that the director defendants did not knowingly cause DISH to violate the DNC laws. The evidence showed that they believed DISH was complying with the DNC laws and that DISH was not legally responsible for DNC violations by retailers. Plaintiffs suggest that the SLC's conclusion is somehow inconsistent with the facts found in the DNC action. But there is no inconsistency. Plaintiffs, in fact, concede that the DNC actions did not explicitly adjudicate whether any director defendant knew DISH was violating DNC laws. That is in their brief. This leaves plaintiffs arguing about inferences that they say may be drawn from the facts found in the DNC actions. Plaintiffs seize upon the SLC's repeated statement that it found no evidence that the director defendants knew that DISH was violating the DNC laws. Plaintiffs say that in the absence of such evidence, the SLC should have concluded that the director defendants knew that DISH was violating the DNC laws based solely upon the supposed inferences from the facts found in the DNC actions. You want me to stop?
I get a little extra time. Yep. I think you're good. And unless we've got other questions, colleagues, any other questions for Mr. Peake? Nope. Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Barron, you got 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you. Let me first, I have two issues I'd like to try to address. The first is Justice Hardesty's conclusion about paragraph 13 of the order. The agreement or the stipulation for an evidentiary hearing, which we understood would need to be conducted after DISH 1, expressly said that was in furtherance of the motion to defer. The motion for summary judgment was defined as the motion to defer. And that is, in fact, what they called their motion in DISH 1, a motion to defer. So there's not two separate motions. The issue of the standard of review was never briefed. It was never brought up until the pre-hearing conference. It was not ruled upon. There was no analysis as to what should be the standard of review. And indeed, all there was oral argument at the end of the evidentiary hearing. Again, no briefing on that issue. I would also argue that this is a very different type of situation than even the demand futility context that, and the typical business judgment rule. Remember, this is in and of itself a unique and great power. Justice Pickering identified it as so, and in fact, in the dissents noted that, you know, to earn the judicial deference, the SLC must demonstrate, usually after allowing plaintiffs discovery into the matter, again, the Rule 56, that no genuine issue of material fact exists regarding the independence and disinterestedness of its director. So again, we all understood, at least my view is that the court understood the process. But here it's very different, right? We know that, again, Justice Pickering cited an opinion out of Delaware which said that this is the only instance in American jurisprudence where a defendant can free itself of a suit. It is a unique power. With it comes a great responsibility to wield. And understand how different this is. This is a motion being brought by a non-party, a party that does not even exist at the time of the wrongdoing, right? The SLC is not in existence at the time. That party has no role in trial. The SLC is a one and done. They have no role in trial. The SLC of independence and good faith is not an element of the offense, unlike what this court held in Schoen and AmeriCorp. May I have a minute?
I'll give you a minute to wrap up.
All right. Unlike what this court said in AmeriCorp and Schoen, right, the issue of demand futility is fundamentally a standing, like the jurisdiction issue that goes on throughout the trial. And indeed, it's the same in Delaware, Maryland, every other court that does a demand futility type of process. Those are issues that come back up at summary judgment and trial. This is not. It is not an element of the offense in any way, shape, or form for the SLC to be independent, good faith, and act and thorough. And finally, the evidence here is not trial evidence. We were severely limited. We didn't even get the entire record that the SLC got. We only got those documents that the SLC purportedly relied upon, because that was the same evidence that was allowed for in Dish 1. And at the hearing, we were severely limited in the questioning we could ask. Because if we even touched upon the thought process, the process that they went through, we were told we could not go there. This was not a trial.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Again, thank you for the briefing and the arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. This court will stand in recess till the next.